third case for argument this morning is Home Protective Services against ADT Security Services.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Lowe. I represent Home Protective Services in this case. This court has been blessed with many fair dealership cases over the years, and they are all quite fact-intensive. Many of them are cases where relationships that don't fall within the confines of the statute are attempted to be shoehorned within the statutory framework, manufacturers, representative cases, and the like. We contend that this case is one that's squarely within the perimeters of what the Wisconsin legislature intended to protect when it enacted the Fair Dealership Act. The district court here found that our case is founded on one of the criteria, that there was no community of interest and did not reach the other criteria. We contend that the court did so erroneously by looking really at one factor to the exclusion of the many facets that the Wisconsin Supreme Court and this court in prior decisions have indicated are necessary to explore.
I'm interested in the standard of review. You've argued this case to us pretty much as if we were just going to ignore the district court and make our own decision. But I wonder whether when you've got one of these 10-factor chopped salad tests, seasoned to taste, whether it isn't the taste of the district court rather than the taste of the appellate court that matters.
Well, Your Honor, in a case where it had gone to trial and the district court had been in a position to listen to testimony,
You were here for the first case. You need to go to trial only when there are disputed issues of material fact. This is not a question of disputed issues of material fact. You all seem to agree on the facts. This is a question of how you characterize the relation that was established by these facts. And it's a problem of attaching a legal conclusion to the facts, but not under a rule that says, if A, then B. It's under a rule that says, think deeply about A through H, and then do something.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, while both parties stipulated that this was something that could be decided as a matter of law, surprisingly to us, the district court found crucial a fact neither really argued, and that was its conclusion that this was a painless transition at the end of the relationship. That is to say, the court concluded that Home Protective Service could easily transfer its business to another alarm company, a competitor of ADT. And I think there's simply no factual record upon which the court could have made that conclusion, and indeed there really was none argued by ADT to support it. So I don't think that kind of finding is one that this court's required to give any special deference to, because it's not based upon any evidence it heard or any other material that was submitted in support of the motions for summary judgment. So in terms of the standard review,
except when you look at what the court did on that point, I mean, what you're referencing, the court used the correct language and I think the correct reasoning. It wasn't just a matter of, I don't think the court brushed it off, talked about it being over the barrel. And so the question is whether the dealer would be unable to negotiate with a grantor or comparison shop with other grantors. Wasn't that the right?
Well, I think what this court has to look at is whether the district court followed the 10 facets and gave proper weight to them, and indeed whether the district court gave deference to all those facets. So I think that if this court concludes that the district court did not examine all of the facets, which the Ziegler case and all the other cases say is necessary, then I don't think that the trial court's decision is entitled to deference. And I think here it's quite clear that the district court did not look at all of the factors. nor did it weigh them appropriately. It seems clear that if there's any case in which someone is over a barrel, this seems to be the case. 100%, 95% of the revenues HPS earned were from this relationship. It was harnessed under a very comprehensive set of dealer guidelines and a dealership agreement, called a dealership agreement, that guided and coordinated every aspect of the relationship. The two governing criteria in these cases are, is there a continuing financial interest, and is there an interdependence? I don't think there's any fair argument that can be made that there is no continuing financial interest.
Well, how do you distinguish this from the Kornacki case? I understand there that we're only talking 75 to 85% of revenue, but here, and it's 95%, but I think that case gives you a problem.
Well, this is a case in which Home Protective Service was precluded by the agreement from carrying any competitive product. So not only was all its revenue from the ADT product, but it was precluded from having any other product in its stable. Many of the cases that this court has faced include manufacturer representatives that carry four or five lines of products. Here, HPS, Home Protective Service, was bound to offer just the one product of ADTs. In addition, this agreement imposed the requirement that there be minimum production and that there be a maximum attrition limitation. So both parties had a continuing interest in existing business as well as new business. And this interdependence plays in the same way, because when these accounts, what happens is home customers might sign up, they might stop paying after 6 months. Well, there was a chargeback to Home Protective Service in the event of those cancellations. And indeed, if too many attrited accounts was the term that the parties ascribed to that situation, if there were canceled accounts, if there were too many of them, the dealership could be terminated. So both parties had a continuing interest in the existing book of business as well as new business. The second element, the second guidepost, is called interdependence of the relationship. That looks to coordination and cooperation toward common goals. And in this case, unlike so many of the other cases, there is such a comprehensive dealer program guidelines, most of which, or good part of which, is attached in our appendix, that in minutia describes the relationship and confines the relationship, requires a number of things be done in coordination with the grantor here, ADT. Every single piece of paper that HPS had to put under the nose of their customers was an ADT logoed document. The contracts, there's a lot of paperwork that goes with every transaction. Even the equipment installed in the home was required to bear the ADT logo. And so the entire face that HPS presented to the customer was as an ADT authorized dealer. And so therefore, in this relationship, Home Protective Service had very little that was independent of ADT. And when they lost this relationship at the end of when it was terminated, they walked away with no book of business. Their entire 6 years of effort was captured by ADT. So clearly, there was an interdependence between the two parties. There was a requirement of promotion. That is to say, Home Protective Service was required to promote ADT in all of its literature, in all of its advertisements. They were prohibited at the same time from promoting any other product. So it's not just the affirmative requirement of promotion, but the prohibition on promoting any competitive product. And for a small business like Patsy Wabiak's business here, where she had four full-time and three part-time employees, to spend 10% of her revenues, which were only $320,000 annually, just to devote 10% of that to logoed advertising with the ADT logo, we contend shows the kind of interdependence and the kind of investment that the cases require. The district court seemed to focus on those cases that talk about automobiles, real estate, buildings, and the like that are, quote, sunk investments in the terminology used in these cases. But I think that that emphasis is to the exclusion of case law, including the Baldwin versus Tri-Clover case, that refers to not just facilities and inventory, but also time, money, employees, and advertising. And this, you know, maybe under the collective word of goodwill, but clearly the investments that this small company made in the ADT dealer relationship in terms of the time, which was all of their time for 6 years, money, all of their money, employees, all of their employees. That's the kind of investment that the Wisconsin legislature was seeking to protect when it enacted this law. And it's not irrelevant that there were barriers that we believe the district court ignored to Home Protective Services reaffiliation at the time that they were terminated. There was a 25-year hands-off any ADT customer. And ADT is the gorilla in this business. There really is no other company on the block that had the kind of market power that ADT had. So the hands-off on that book of business was a significant detriment in the relationship that really hamstrung HPS in going out at the end of this relationship. In addition, there's a forfeiture of renewal income at the time of termination. And you'll find this at the appendix, page 32 in the dealer agreement, that upon reaffiliation with a competitive alarm company, Home Protective Services forfeited any renewal income that it otherwise would have been entitled to receive at the time this relationship terminated. So to return to the point, Judge Easterbrook, that you mentioned at the beginning, in terms of standard review, we believe the district court inappropriately reached out and found that it was a painless, quote, free agency at the time of its termination. There was $63,000 in one-time losses, $14,000 a month in recurring loss. That, of course, goes to future profit, but it's still a factor to consider in this multifaceted test. HPS was required to lay off employees. They were down to Dave and Patsy, the owners.
I would assume the question whether the forfeiture of renewal income is valid is an interesting question of Wisconsin law independent of the Dealership Act. What is the status of that provision under Wisconsin law? That's a very powerful form of non-compete agreement.
Well, under Wisconsin law, which this issue wasn't faced at all by the district court, but
did you raise it?
No, Your Honor. This
right,
was
well.
a straight claim.
District courts resolve issues raised by plaintiffs.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. But it was.
Do you know what its status is under Wisconsin law, independent of this dealership?
The enforceability of such a provision, a forfeiture of the renewal stream. I believe that there's no barrier to that under Wisconsin law. Unless it's a violation of a restrictive covenant, that's the only statute that comes.
Most states, as I understand it, treat that kind of clause the same as a restrictive covenant, and will enforce it under circumstances where they would enforce restrictive covenants and not otherwise. I just wonder. Well, but since you haven't raised it, there's no point in getting into it.
Well, but I think the short answer to the question is that the Wisconsin decision seemed to enforce covenants that apply to a customer that the individual who's now terminated dealt with face-to-face. And so, therefore, it's because the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law would offer protection that the restrictive covenant law might not offer that we contend there is a real tangible harm. I would like at this time, if I could, to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Lowe. Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to address a few of the points that Mr. Lowe addressed in his argument and also some additional points this morning. The first and primary focus of the appellant's argument in this case is that the district court did not apply the proper standard and instead focused on what Mr. Lowe has referred to as a painless transition. I think that the appellant's argument mischaracterizes what the district court did. The district court instead did exactly what the Wisconsin Supreme Court asked that trial courts do in the Ziegler case, what the Supreme Court asked that it do in the Baldwin case, and what it asked most recently in the Central Corp case. That is, apply each of the 10 Ziegler facets. And that's what the district court did here, appropriately so. It focused on one other issue, or one all-encompassing description of the community of interest issue, and that is whether ADT had home protective over a barrel, which is a phrase that I think this court first used in the Fleet Wholesale case some years back, and most recently used in the Prefke case. That over-a-barrel situation occurs when a dealer has invested much of its capital in firm-specific investments that are tailored to a particular grantor. There's been no argument here. There can't be an argument. There were substantial capital investments in the ADT home protective relationship. Instead, what happened here is that ADT bought customer contracts from Home Protective. That essentially is all that this relationship involved. There was de minimis use of a trademark. There was no Home Protective did not take advantage of all the marketing programs, all of the helpful hints that were in the guidelines that Mr. Lowe held up a moment ago. In fact, Home Protective did nothing except send out a weekly solicitation within its market area. And what's important to remember about that market area is that in that market area, one of its principal competitors was ADT. It had its own sales force on the ground competing for the same customers. And in all the other cases that the appellant relies upon, in particular the Moody case, where this court found a community of interest, one of the things that was central to that finding, in our view, was that there were exclusive territories or there were capital investments, as Mr. Lowe alluded to. Here we have a situation where Home Protective had no protection from either ADT or other ADT dealers that were in the same marketplace. There simply was no tie like that tie that is to be protected by the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. One of the issues that they focus on also as an investment is the notion that these weekly mailers constituted an investment in the relationship. I think by their very nature, weekly mailers, and that's all the solicitation or advertising Home Protective ever did during this relationship, these weekly mailers were in fact simply an operating expense. They don't represent a capital investment of any kind. It's the only marketing that this company did. It did not go out and solicit customers other than through these weekly mailers. The evidence in the record is clear. And what they got for that was an annual return of revenues that were, by definition, 10 times greater than the amount they invested, so-called invested, in these weekly mailers. Counsel pointed to the Baldwin case as highlighting the question of whether the purported dealer's employee's time could be considered in addressing the community of interest issue. The statement he read to you from Baldwin was, in fact, dicta. Baldwin didn't have anything to do at its core with a community of interest question. Baldwin focused on the question that this court certified to the Wisconsin Supreme Court as to when a dealership should be considered situated in the state of Wisconsin. In that case, therefore, it was appropriate for the Supreme Court to mention time spent by employees in the state of Wisconsin in determining whether a dealership is situated in that state. That decision had nothing to do with the community of interest issue that is before you today. One last point that I'd like to make on the community of interest issue, that is the question of whether the district court focused improperly on this so-called painless transition. I don't believe the district court did. The district court went on from that brief discussion where it referred to Home Protective as a free agent to discuss the question of whether lost profits in and of themselves could constitute sufficient grounds for a finding of community of interest. And the court relied properly on precedent from this court and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in saying that lost profits are not enough. And I think what that brings to mind is a hypothetical that could have occurred in this case. That is, if this transition were so painful, let's assume that Home Protective had simply ceased doing business. There would be a lost future profits claim But that lost future profit claim is a damage claim. It has nothing to do with whether there was, during the existence of the relationship, a community of interest. That's what our cases tell us, is that lost profits are not to be considered, and I think the district court properly disregarded that. The district court also properly considered Ms. Wabick's own testimony, where she said she did not feel dependent on ADT. That's in the record. That's what she said when she was asked about the relationship. The last point I wanted to address is with respect to the non-competition agreement that Mr. Lowe alluded to. Most of the provisions of the non-competition agreement went away upon the termination of the relationship. The one term that still was in existence potentially was the narrow restriction on contacting ADT customers. If the court would look at the record, it would find in the appendix that Ms. Wabick, and it's on section 6.2.1 of the agreement, it's at page 23 of the appellant's appendix, Ms. Wabick herself crossed out words in the non-compete, crossed out the words indirectly solicit, she crossed out the word advertise to. In other words, she was in a position as the purported dealer here to modify the dealer agreement, to change the non-compete about which she now complains. There was no community of interest. This court should affirm the district court's judgment. If there are any questions from the court, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I've finished my argument.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wright.
Thank you very much.
Anything further, Mr. Lowe?
Just a few points.
May it please the court. The standard of review, according to this court in the Freiberg Farm case, is a de novo standard of review. I don't know if that clarifies to any extent Your Honor's question, but de novo seems to imply that it's to this court's function to look at these 10 facets, to look at the two guidelines, and to apply them in a de novo fashion. Secondly, the point about Baldwin, which I cited for the proposition that not just capital investments, but the investment of time and money are recognized by the Wisconsin Supreme Court as indicators of the kind of investment to which the statute was designed to afford protection, I would refer the court to the Ziegler decision itself, which sets forth the comprehensive test, and that talks about inventory, facilities, and goodwill. And I think in this case, this is the kind of business that doesn't have warehouses in a showroom. People don't come.
Yes. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.